Welcome back to this second hour of Leading Edge Medicine. Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan. Lynette has the weekend off. Mark Holland filling in for Lynette and taking your calls at 206-644-6006, 206-644-6006. Both doctors with us once again today. Dr. Mixon, Dr. Umat taking your calls, and we've got several people on the line. Let's get right to it with Ray in Woodinville with some interesting question. Ray, what's your question for the doctors? No, Ray just dropped off.
Oh my goodness.
His question, I got a bit of it here, is what's the difference between calcium clockers versus beta blockers?
Oh, calcium channel blockers, maybe.
Yes, that's
beta
right.
Beta blockers, yeah.
Well, calcium channel blockers as opposed to beta blocker. Beta blockers slow your heart rate.
I was just put on one of those, okay. A beta blocker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People with rapid atrial fibrillation or rapid sinus tachycardia, we use beta blockers to slow their heart rate down. And they're like everything, have a mixed profile of risk and benefit. Mm. The good news is your heart rate slows, your blood pressure tends to drop. They were originally used primarily as blood pressure drugs. Mm. And now they're used more and more in cardiology for people that have had a heart attack to prevent their hearts from racing too fast and overworking. But because they keep your heart rate from picking up, they can trigger fatigue in some people. Mm. And they can cause depression in some people. Mm. So depressive disorders and fatigue and exercise intolerance all increase with beta blockers. Mm. So calcium channel blockers, once more, were designed as blood pressure drugs. They do dilate your blood vessels. They do cause your blood pressure to drop because you're pumping the same amount of blood through bigger vessels. But again, they have some adverse effects. And they can cause heart rates to slow down, especially in people with atrial fibrillation. And sometimes they're used for that purpose. If you've got atrial fibrillation, they'll use a calcium channel blocker to try to slow your heart rate. That is one of the choices they've got. Postural hypotension is a bit more of a problem with them sometimes. People will stand up and get dizzy. So, I don't know. What are you thinking about these?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. They block the calcium channels in the heart, and that's how they work to cause lower blood pressure. But amlodipine, one of the classic calcium channel blockers, is a very popular drug that works extremely well.
On that, too.
And also has the side effect of helping brain, so prevents memory loss.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, a very nice drug with low dose and very little side effects. Mm-hmm. But, both of them very commonly used. The beta blockers were one of the first class of drugs that were used, but
the beta blockers have been around, golly gee, I mean, they were established therapy back in the 1970s when I was a new young doctor. Mm. So, you know, they've been around a long, long time.
Mm.
Okay, interesting information. Let's move on to John in Tacoma. He has, I don't know what this is, but John in Tacoma, if you're there, what's your question for the doctors?
So this is a follow-on of previous calls. So
okay.
My wife took combi patches for a long time and then switched to Medicare, and it was like, okay, $250 a month, and so that was a bit much. So she shifted, asked her doctor what to do, and he came up with estradiol pills. And I called you guys up, and you said, "Yeah, not really."
No, don't like estradiol. Estradiol's okay, just not as a pill.
Right, and so she switched over, I think, to another doctor, but. So anyway, they done estradiol patches at 0.05 milligrams per day, mm-hmm. and progesterone pills at 100 milligrams a day.
Okay.
And I was just wondering if that's a good treatment.
Depends on the levels.
Yeah, it's a reasonable starting point. The question in our minds is, Dr. Umat and I kind of look at each other and we're thinking the same thing. What are her blood levels?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not what's in the package. It's not what you put on your skin. It's not what you put in your mouth. It's how much of it is actually in your bloodstream.
Yeah, and again, to your point, Jerry, it's also only two of the multiple other hormones that are part of hormone replacement therapy.
Yes.
And if they're only going to be able to do two, well, are these two good and adequate? Well, they're better than nothing. Are they adequate? We don't know. Well, what about testosterone? What about healing and repair? What about DHEA? What about pregnenolone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, she's getting bits and pieces of what she needs. She's not getting the best. And that's just all there is to it. I don't know how to make it much clearer than
curiosity
that.
Curiosity was whether estriol would be better than estradiol or.
No.
Depends on what we're treating.
Yeah.
And depends on her history.
Yeah. Estriol is an estrogen that is very common. You make most of it when you're pregnant. You make a little bit of it at other times. It's an anti-cancer estrogen. It actually slows the growth of most breast cancer. That's the good news for it. It's fairly effective on bladder function. It's not quite as good as vaginal mucosa improvement, but okay. Estradiol is the most potent human estrogen. That's the one that's actually made by the ovaries. So, you know, if you're trying to give a person more youthful estrogen functions, estradiol is the drug to use.
Estradiol is most effective for brain and for bone.
Yep.
And estriol does not have those functions.
Yep.
However, it is the estrogen of choice if cancer and breast cancer particularly are present or have been present or are a risk.
Yeah, so if we get a woman who comes in and she's a breast cancer survivor, you know, we'll be very cautious with the estradiol, but we'll be quite generous with the estriol because, if anything, it slows cancer production. But, you know, if we're trying to protect her bones, then you need that estradiol to give her the best, newest bone formation. But once more, the primary sex hormone, the primary steroid in a young woman is not even an estrogen at all. It's testosterone.
Right, but when we use estrogen for most of our women, there are exceptions, so we do personalize their care. It is a combination of estradiol and estriol, always.
Right. Yes, it is.
And the combination ratio varies between what the patient needs and how old she is.
But that combination is estradiol, estriol, testosterone, progesterone, pregnenolone,
indeed.
Thyroid.
Indeed. And not all in one combination,
right.
Differently, so it allows us to change the dose depending upon how the patient responds to the dose we start them on.
Precisely. But that's my point, is she's getting parts of it. But even for female sex steroids, she's missing the primary one, the one that a young woman has got 2.5 to 3 times more testosterone.
But you can't blame her medical provider for not doing it. He doesn't know what, or she, they don't do it, and they don't know what to do about it.
And, but that, that's precisely my point.
Yeah.
She's getting second-rate care. She's not getting
the
best.
The primary issue is hot flashes or whatever.
Yeah, well, again, that's that's... She's taking enough that will suppress her hot flashes, probably, if that's what she's after. But then you're looking just at a clinical endpoint. But why not draw her blood and test her estradiol levels and see where they are?
Yeah. I mean, the vasomotor symptoms of postmenopause are important, and estradiol will definitely suppress those symptoms. But when we cannot use adequate doses of estrogen, testosterone is our go-to, and that has been shown quite clearly with Dr. Rebecca Glazer's work. And she has published extensively on how beneficial this hormone is for those vasomotor symptoms.
It stops the hot flashes and the mood swings. It gives her better vaginal function. It lowers the risk of breast cancer. It improves her mood, helps get rid of depression. And I don't understand why most doctors are so afraid of giving it to women. Because the benefits are legion.
I suggested she go in to your guy's place, because I've been there for years. And she did get the $600 screening.
Well, good. So, she got the screening. Now we got to treat her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or somebody needs to treat her. She wants to take those tests, and if her, you know, if her primary care doctor is that rare physician who actually understands what to do with all that lab.
Well, that's very interesting you say that. I had patients that join our clinic, and they told me that they were going to stay with us for 1 year, and at the end of the 1 year, they were going to take all the information they had accumulated in the 1 year and take it to their primary care provider and have her take care of them. Well, it turned out that she was a good friend of mine. So when they transferred their care to her, she sent me a note, and she goes, "I can't do this."
No, she can't. She doesn't know. We are a specialty clinic. They are not our specialty. It's like asking a psychiatrist to take care of your heart disease. It's the wrong specialty. You don't expect people that are specialists in one field to handle a different field. And that's what's happening in modern medicine. We've got these doctors that don't do what we do, trying to treat the problems that we treat, and they don't do a very good job of it. That's just the real world.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, take care, sir.
Good luck to your wife. I hope she has a great experience.
That opens up a line for you. If you're listening today, you got a question for Dr. Mixon or Dr. Umat, you can call in that question right now at 206-644-6006. That's 206-644-6006. We'll be back with a call from Mike in Seattle in just a moment. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, back in just a few moments. And welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics. Dr. Mixon, Dr. Umat in studio today to take your call at 206-644-6006, 206-644-6006. And we have Mike, who's been waiting for a little bit here. Mike, you have a question for the doctors about supplements?
I'm in my mid-70s, and I wonder what supplements, vitamins, or nutrients would you take to help build your muscles at my age, besides for testosterone.
Okay. Well, dehydroepiandrosterone, DHEA, enough to keep your blood level between 300 and 500. So whatever dose that takes, again, it's not what you put in your mouth, it's what's in your bloodstream, and everybody's metabolism is a bit different.
Astaxanthin.
Astaxanthin has good research, especially in older people, folks suffering from sarcopenia, those who have been on 10 milligrams of astaxanthin a day for, you know, 3 to 6 months tend to have better exercise tolerance and better grip strength and so on. Carnitine, mm-hmm. Acetyl-L-carnitine is another one that increases muscle strength and endurance.
Mm-hmm. Protein in general.
Proteins in general, but also the, there was another one. It's just kind of
flipping. Taurine?
Taurine does increase strength, and it's actually the kind of the new drug that is being researched as a longevity drug. Uh-huh. Although it's not a prescription drug, it's a supplement. Yeah. What is the one that's decreased from the statins?
CoQ10?
Coenzyme Q10. Mm-hmm. Yeah, CoQ10, again, helps to increase mitochondria.
Decreases muscle pain quite significantly, actually.
It does. And then some of the niacin analogs.
Mm-hmm. Very good for heart health, for cardiovascular health.
Nicotinamide riboside. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nicotinamide riboside
NAD.
Is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, then glutamine too, right?
Yeah.
And then we are thinking about doing those as IV drips as well.
So, but of course, that wouldn't be a supplement he'd take daily.
No, he couldn't. Yeah. But, you know, if you're going to enhance absorption of nutrients, then IV is a very good way to do, especially for people who have difficulty swallowing them and people who are dehydrated. You know, I find that men, as they get older and have prostate issues and don't want to pee too much, they drink less water. And mm-hmm. so when we give them a boost of IV fluids and nourishment, we see such an improvement in their mood, their energy, their zest for life.
Yeah, they're not chronically dehydrated
anymore.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a list of things, all of which have data to show that any one of them can increase strength and endurance. So, you want to give us a little context. What are you trying to accomplish exactly?
Do you have sarcopenia?
No. I've just built more muscle. I mean, you know, I've lost a little bit over the times. I used to be a wrestler in college. I did real well.
Good.
And I was in a hard field in construction. I was iron worker, putting rebar into concrete structures, and that was always a really hard job. And you really, you know, you built your muscles, you had to have them.
Sure.
But since I've retired, they've gone downhill some, and I want to build them back up. I want to get back to where I would like to be.
Sure.
And I'm just wondering what different things would be helpful.
Well, do your resistance training now that you're retired and make sure you take an adequate amount of protein either right before or immediately after a workout so that you don't hurt so much. And then CoQ10, definitely, like Jerry mentioned. Protein can be any source of protein, either a premixed protein drink or food, whatever you really like.
And creatine monohydrate, that's the other one. Mm. Yeah, the creatine. So, you know, I guess we've given you a list of 5 or 6 different things, all of which have some studies.
I mean, there is, we cannot use growth hormone, but growth hormone has been shown to help build muscle in people.
Dramatically.
You know, and then we do use amino acids in our clinic, triple aminos.
Mm-hmm. To help you increase your own production of growth hormone.
Right, yeah. So, ornithine lysine combination.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay, is that helpful, Mike?
Very.
All right.
Okay.
Well, and, you know, if you want to get the big guns, come see us as a patient, and then we'll really get you leaping, cavorting, dancing into the night and having a wonderful life.
I mean, given what he did, Jerry, as a wrestler, not only is the muscle been helpful for him overall, it has also made sure his bones are very strong.
Yes.
So you want to maintain those gains through your career and your profession.
The last thing you want to do now that you've retired is get fragile.
Yeah. Don't get fragile.
Okay.
Good luck to you, sir.
All right.
Thanks, Mike. That opens up a line for you. If you're listening today, a question for the doctors at 206-644-6006. We have John in Granite Falls. He has a question about liver cancer. You're on the show, John.
Yeah, hey, docs. Love your show. I've been listening to it for years, and every once in a while I've called in with a question here and there. But if I could beg your indulgence, I wanted to just share a tiny story and bring up some information that I think would be really helpful to all the listeners. And I have a sister who's just right around 70, and about 4 years ago she suddenly turned up with some real serious liver cancer. And she is the last person on the planet you would think could ever come up with a cancer. She's, you know, eats really healthy, works out constantly. And you guys have always promoting, you know, physical activity. And
absolutely,
this is like working out that she does. And she ended up with a cancer. And then subsequent to this, you know, discovery and surgery that she had to have for this cancer, she's had multiple other tumors kind of show up here and there. And the doctor who's treating her has done surgeries, and they've been successful. But she obviously is, whatever's happening there is not working. And so I've been really frustrated and sorrowful about what's happening for her. And you know, just recently she commented about this last time she got, you know, discovered another tumor. She was talking about being scared and angry and frustrated and all that. And I, as it turns out, coincidentally ended up seeing on YouTube a program with a doctor here who's come up with, I think, you know, bold and total revolutionary approach to understanding cancer. And I thought, again, if I can beg your indulgence, you know, to bring up this doctor's name. And it's Dr. Thomas Seyfried, S-E-Y-F-R-I-E-D. And he's talking about one of the big culprits with all these cancers, liver and all of them, and you guys have been talking about cancers quite a bit today, and that the two big culprits are glucose and glutamine. And that the idea is that these guys are feeding off of this excess glucose in our bodies where these cancers are concerned. And he's done a whole body of study on this, 30 years of research. And I'm really amazed at that this is kind of a spoiler alert for our whole approach with cancer and so forth. And I know, Samira, you've talked today about with the guy who was asking about, you know, foods not to have, you know, with the prostate cancer. And you mentioned
Walter Longo's
sugar.
Work, yeah, and sugar.
And
Walter Longo's done a lot of work.
You were talking about the glycosinating, yeah, the sugar, you know, damage in our brain and whatnot. And so he's promoting, you know, and he, again, has a whole treatise on all this information here. And he's talking about the ketonic diet. Probably this isn't for everybody, because I know from my own, you know, intermittent fasting, it's not that easy. But if you're faced with, you know, these serious cancers, and if a ketonic kind of diet could really help. And so what I wanted to ask, my question for you guys is, if we could have you guys look at this some more. This is definitely leading edge to me, and it's this whole thing of standing up for ourselves instead of doing the regular standard of care, which you guys have talked about in your show so often, of you know, not promoting the standard of care, trying to be out ahead of it with the leading edge on it. And I think this is a whole another approach here, which is just fascinating, and I think can be really effective for a lot of people.
All right, hold it. Okay. First of all, glucose is blood sugar. Okay. That is the sugar that our bodies use as the primary fuel to stay alive. So everything you eat, except fats, eventually get broken down to glucose. So simple carbohydrates, bread, rice, pastas, pastries, these things are basically complex sugars. That's what a carbohydrate is. And it all gets broken down to make glucose. And so when we're measuring your A1C, we're measuring the average glucose level in your bloodstream over the course of the last 3 to 4 months. That's part of why we try to get everybody's A1C down to 5.2 or less, because the higher your average blood sugar, the higher your average glucose, the higher your risk of dementia, cancer, strokes, heart disease, osteoarthritis. They're all triggered by those high sugar loads. We are in full accord here, but it's my big difference is it's not that new and shocking. It's the sort of thing we've been trying to preach to people for the last 25 years on this program.
Right. I understand that, but I haven't heard, kind of the discussion going in the direction that, in fact, if their cancers show up, mm-hmm. That they can be treated with this ketonic kind of diet where we're reducing that glucose and mindful of not just that glucose is not so good, but that it really is one of the foods that these cancers live off of.
Yes, but let me back it up.
Now, okay.
You will die without glucose. Okay. Glucose is the primary fuel that your body needs to stay alive. We don't want to totally get rid of glucose. Okay. We want to get your levels even and low. We don't want to have glucose spikes. We don't want to have high average levels either. So,
reduce it down to a point where it stresses these tumors.
Yes,
really, a lot.
It is so possible. But what we're looking at here is, again, you got to avoid the sugars, avoid the simple carbohydrates, and avoid how much of them you eat. We got a break coming up here. You hear this music. We'll be right back, and I'm going to talk a little bit about sugar loads and cancers. Okay.
Okay, back with Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment. Room for maybe a couple more calls here before the top of the hour. 206-644-6006. This is Leading Edge Medicine, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics.
Living on love, buying on time. Without somebody, nothing ain't worth a dime. Just like an old.
And welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics. Dr. Mixon, Dr. Reumat, taking your calls at 206-644-6006. Got into kind of a debate about glucose. Can't live your life without some glucose, is what you're saying.
Well, yes, you die. I mean, it's pretty simple. Dying is not a good thing. Well, I guess there are situations I'd rather die.
We are all going to die one day. That's
right.
That's inevitable.
But I'm in no hurry.
Yes.
I'm having way too much fun.
Not in any hurry,
I plan to continue. So let's talk about, first of all, I want to correct one of your phrases, your terminology, okay? It's not ketonic. It's ketotic. Okay. What you're trying to do is increase the number of ketone bodies that you are producing. And ketones are a byproduct of fat metabolism. So if you are eating low enough calorie that you're burning your own body fat, you become ketotic. Okay. And the other way is to induce ketosis is to eat a high fat diet. And by avoiding carbohydrates and having a high-fat diet, you become ketotic. And it's true that that ketone-producing diet has been shown to enhance the lifespan of several cancers, the most notable one being glioblastoma, which is 100% fatal, average lifespan 15 months. But I've got a friend whose spouse is on a high ketone diet and high resveratrol and high, she's taking, I think, 4 relief factor a day to get. There are things we can do that will help improve the lifespan of a lot of people with cancers. Liver cancer is a fascinating cancer in many ways. And, you know, I'm sorry that you're, is it your sister you said that has the cancer?
I think he's dropped off,
oh,
John.
Oh, you think he dropped off.
I think
okay.
It was his sister.
It was his sister, yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know, fascinating cancer because he's talking about how fit and how much she exercised. And, of course, that gives her a good immune response, which I think helped protect her. But I saw a thing put out by the National Institute of Health this past week that said that in America today, 51% of all of the liver and gallbladder cancers are caused by being overweight.
Interesting.
You know, we've said for years that being overweight and certainly being obese, but even just
overweight,
not just overweight, causes 51% of all the liver and gallbladder cancers in America. I mean, that's scary as all get out. The next biggest cause that we know of for liver cancer is hepatitis C. And hepatitis C is a virus that a lot of boomers carry without knowing it. And it's an outgrowth of our somewhat loose lifestyle in the 1960s. Many children of the 60s, we were the free love generation. Okay. And hepatitis C was spread sexually. And so an awful lot of people that had a variety of partners in the 60s have carried hepatitis C the rest of their life.
And asymptomatically, maybe.
And they have no symptoms.
Right.
Hepatitis C typically will give you some symptoms for a week or two. You get it, and a few weeks after you're infected, you kind of get tired and blah, and you kind of run down and feel under the weather. But you don't have classic hepatitis symptoms. But it does attack the liver. And then the symptoms go away. And 20, 30, 40 years later, you get the liver cancer. And so it's, you know, it's kind of a late effect of your adolescent fun. And so if we're looking at between being overweight and hepatitis C, those two things account for three out of every four liver cancers in America. I mean, that's really kind of neat. Now, if his sister is negative for hep C and she stayed lean and fit, then she is that real rarity that falls into that last 20-some percent that get liver cancer from other causes. And, you know, even there we've got things, we know that petroleum distillates, for instance, people who work at refineries or even gas station attendants. Now, these days, most people pump their own gas. But it was a gas station attendant thing. People who spent all day pumping gas and breathing the petroleum fumes had an increased risk of liver cancer. Okay. That's become less of an issue, except, of course, in Oregon, where it's against the law to pump your own gas. So there, they're just, the legislature just wants to kill off the gas station attendants, I guess.
I've heard that they're canceling that here pretty soon.
Well,
you get to pump your own gas in Oregon.
Well, that would be nice. But he is right that, you know, the ketosis lowers the progression of several cancers, and liver cancer is among them. So, but you know, my difference with him is not in the fact. My difference is in the couching of this as a new breakthrough that people are not aware of. Most of us that follow, you know, the causes and cures for cancer are well aware that a ketotic diet is indeed of benefit with a fair number of tumors. Is it a cure for all cancers? No. I wish it was. But it's not a cure for all cancers. And that's where the hype parts ways with the science. Mm. There are people that are promoting this as, quote, the cure for cancer, and that if people will just go on a zero sugar, zero carbohydrate, only fat and protein diet, that their cancers will miraculously fade away. Now, I would point out it does occasionally happen. Mm. There are anecdotal reports of people whose cancers did completely go away, so it can happen. Mm. But it is not the usual and customary thing that happens. Mm. So,
well, we have Robert in Golden Gardens as a question real quick here. We'll be taking a break, but maybe we can start the question from Robert in Golden Gardens. What's your question for the doctors, Robert?
Hello. Hopefully my question is useful for somebody. I don't know. My phone is cutting in and out. I'm asking a question about protein intake and sarcopenia. And everybody's always suggested protein intake is good for sarcopenia, but I just read an article in British Geriatrics just lately out, says the title of which is Higher Dietary Protein Intake is Associated with Sarcopenia in Older British Twins. And the article seems to be saying that if you have a high protein intake, you increase your sarcopenia. You know anything about that article, or am I reading it wrong?
I don't know that particular article. I would certainly be interested because it's at odds with most of what we know about aging and protein.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a new study, and it's not a lightweight study. It's from Age and Aging magazine, like I say, British Geriatric Society. But the actual conclusion is low protein intake was protective of low muscle mass, while high protein intake was associated with an increased odds of having low muscle mass. In terms of sarcopenia, no significant association was noted for low protein intake. However, high protein intake was significantly associated with sarcopenia. And this was robust to adjustment in all models.
Okay, well, I'd like to, we'll have to pull the study and take a look. Let's chat about it a bit when we get back. So we got to take a break. You hear the music? But we shall come back and chat about old folks and protein.
Okay. As Leading Edge Medicine continues in just a moment, Dr. Mixon, Dr. Umat here taking your calls. Maybe one more call we could fit in, 206-644-6006. Back with more of Leading Edge Medicine, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinic. We'll come back in just a couple
Isn't
of minutes.
Yep.
Leading Edge Medicine is brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics. Our doctors during that break were looking up this study that Robert from Golden Gardens brought up about protein intake. And you guys, just in that break, came up with some interesting information.
Yeah.
We did indeed.
Well, we actually, Samira pulled up that particular study, and indeed it says just what he said, is that in that study, which was a pretty good size study, the people with high protein intake had more sarcopenia than the people with low protein intake. On the other hand, we also came up with a National Institute of Health study published the previous year that was a meta-analysis that looked at basically all the studies that had been published and put them together and said the opposite, mm-hmm. that high protein intake and that low protein intake was the one associated with sarcopenia.
Yeah.
Dr. Longo, who studies, says that low protein intake does better for us.
Right.
And that, in fact, you should do plant protein.
Yeah.
But then last summer, I came up with another study that said that, indeed, older people who needed more animal protein because they got more sarcopenia with the vegetable proteins. And what this highlights is the difficulties we always have in medicine. This is the war in studies.
Yeah.
You can find studies on both sides of almost any question.
Mm-hmm.
And the question we have is, what is the preponderance of the evidence on any aspect? And what are the confounding components?
Mm-hmm.
When I come across a situation like this, what I usually do is I go back and look at the basic physiology, and I look at how human beings developed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me give you my little talk. I've got 10 minutes here. I don't know if I'm going to take it all. We will end up with another caller, but let me do this anyway. Our ancestors, as animals go, our ancestors were pretty weak in tooth and claw. Our fangs are pretty punny things compared to even a pussycat. And our claws, our fingernails, are fragile.
They can be sharp, though.
They can be sharp, but they break. So, you know, our ancestors were not great hunters. They're not fast. They're not that strong. We can't rip out their throat with our teeth, and we can't drag them to death with our claws. And so,
try
our ancestors. Have I tried? No, I nibble once in a while, but that was back in my dating days. Nibbles can be fun, though. Anyway.
That's not what I was imagining. I was out in the Sahara Desert and trying to, you know, bite at something. But anyway.
I see. No. Fact is that a bobcat or a coyote can kill the average human being.
Yes.
We are not that tough.
Uh-huh.
Take us our tools away and we're pretty punny critters. And so our ancestors, before we developed, you know, rifles and bows and arrows and slingshots and stuff, we were mostly scavengers, and we attacked fruits and berries and leaves and roots because they couldn't outrun us and they couldn't outfight us. So we were primarily vegetable and tuber eaters, and we got such meat as we could. And that was the biggest impetus for us for developing agriculture and husbandry, where we could actually keep animals captive that couldn't outrun us and didn't have a chance to fight us.
Yeah, not keeping a husband, but
that's right. Husbandry, not husbands. Although the root of the name is the same.
Just making sure people are listening.
Husbandry is when you domesticate a wild creature for your benefit, and that's what a husband is. A domesticated man who is kept for the benefit of the woman.
Sure.
Anywho. So what really happened to us is we developed a genome that said that we were supposed to get fat in the spring, the summer, the fall, during that period of time when most of the food was available. Our ancestors ate as much as they could, and they got as fat as they could because winter was coming. And when winter came, food was going to be in a very short supply. And so people who went into the winter skinny died. Mm. And they were not the ones able to reproduce and have babies. So we selected ourselves a genome that said we are genetically coded to eat the fattest, richest, highest calorie food we could, and our genome says if it's available, keep eating it.
Mm.
Okay. When we tell people to not do that, we're asking people to do an inherently unnatural act. We're telling people, ignore what your genetic code is telling you to do. Mm-hmm. Limit your food intake. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yes, we crave meat because it is high fat, high calorie. It helps us to get fat, okay? And that's why we are opportunistic carnivores. We'll eat meat whenever it's available, okay? What we've got now is a situation in which the genetic code that allowed our ancestors to survive is what is killing us today, because obesity is what's killing Americans. That's why our average lifespan is dropping, not rising. Mm. The overweight is now causing cancers and heart disease and dementia, and it's killing us off. And so we have to learn to ignore our genome. The other part of our genome is for the guy who called about the sugar. Okay, The good Lord put a lot of sugar in human breast milk. Breast milk is really sweet. And that was to guarantee that babies would drink it and would crave it and would go for that breast at every opportunity. So again, our genome is designed for us to get as fat as possible, and it actually is designed for us to seek out sweet food because that harks back to the breast milk upon which we were all nourished in our early life. So our cravings for sugar, our cravings for fat, our cravings for meat, our cravings to clean our plates and eat everything we possibly can whenever it's available is all genetically coded in the modern human being. And so overeating and gaining weight is not a moral failing. It doesn't make you a bad person. What it makes you is a bad planner, because what you're doing is giving in to what your genetic code is telling you to do. You are doing the natural thing. It's that natural thing that kills us in our unnaturally rich world, in which unlimited supply of sweet, high-calorie, simple carbohydrate meats that we can grill and call it, put cancer in our colons are in unlimited supply. That's our biggest problem in America today. We're down to...
We've gotten down to the wire here.
Yeah. So basically, you know, I can't tell you which of the studies is true, but I'm going to tell you what my gut tells me. When I look at the way our ancestors ate and I look at the way our genome is built, I am of the opinion that, yes, protein is important, but we don't want to overdo it. I think overdoing protein, and meat is the easiest way to overdo protein, is probably bad for us. But when it comes to sarcopenia, I'm going to take a couple of minutes quickly on sarcopenia. The biggest killer of us for sarcopenia is senescent cells. The buildup of senescent cells in our system. As we age and as we gain weight, we make more and more senescent cells. And it's those senescent cells that inhibit the reproduction of healthy muscular cells. And so we need to limit our senescent cells. And senescent cell therapy, I think, is going to be more important for improving human lifespan than any other therapy we've got. If we can have a lean, exercising population with minimal senescent cells, I think that's going to be our closest we've got to a fountain of youth.
Okay, that'll do it for this week's edition of Leading Edge Medicine. Find out more about the clinic at lmclinic.com. You can also book your appointment for a free health analysis at 1-866-86-YOUNG. That's 1-866-86-YOUNG. Mark Holland is my name, filling in for Lynette Morgan this week. She'll be back next time. Thank you for joining us for Leading Edge Medicine, brought to you by Longevity Medical Clinics.